Chapter 1. The War Within. Introduction. Shri Krishna consoles and instructs Prince Arjuna as he is about to go into battle against family and friends to defend his older brother's claim to the ancient throne of the Kurus. Thus the great scripture called the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of the Lord, begins. Shri Krishna is Bhagavan, the Lord, the mysterious incarnation of Lord Vishnu, the aspect of God who fosters and preserves the universe against the forces constantly working to destroy and corrupt it. Krishna has appeared on earth as a royal prince of the house of the Yadavas. Thus he combines earthly majesty with a hidden spiritual power. Most know him only as an unimportant prince, but the wise have seen him reveal his power to destroy evil and protect the good. The battle of the Bhagavad Gita is not Krishna's fight, however. It is Arjuna's. Krishna is only Arjuna's charioteer and advisor. He has promised Arjuna that he will be with him throughout the ordeal, but much as he passionately hopes for Arjuna's victory, he has sworn to be a non-combatant in the struggle. A charioteer's position is a lowly one compared to the status and glory of the warrior he drives. But Krishna assumes this modest role out of love for Arjuna. As charioteer, he is in a perfect position to give advice and encouragement to Arjuna without violating his promise not to join the fight himself. To secure their claim to the throne, Arjuna and his brothers must fight not an alien army, but their own cousins, who have held the kingdom for many years. Tragically, the forces against them include their own uncle, the blind king Dhritarashtra, and even the revered teachers and elders who guided Arjuna and his brothers when they were young. Arjuna, of course, wants to win the throne for his brother, who is the rightful heir to the Kuru dynasty and has endured many wrongs, but he is dismayed at the prospect of fighting his own people. Thus, on the morning the great battle is to begin, he turns to Krishna, his friend and spiritual advisor, and asks him the deeper questions about life that he's never asked before. The Bhagavad Gita is Krishna's answer. Other warriors who appear elsewhere in the drama are mentioned in this first chapter of the Gita. To Indians, these are familiar figures from the legendary past, but to most Western readers, they will be unknown and even unpronounceable names. Arjuna and his brothers are known as the Pandavas, the sons of Pandu. Yudhishthira, Bhima, Arjuna, Sahadeva, and Nakula. The other side is called the Kauravas, the sons of Kuru. This is somewhat misleading, for both sides of the royal family are Kurus by birth. But the Pandavas are now in the position of appearing to be the dissident faction, so they are called sons of Pandu, to distinguish them from the larger family. Pandu was once king of the kingdom of Hastinapura, but he retired into the forest on spiritual retreat and died young. His elder brother, Dhritarashtra, was blind since birth, so he was never named ruler, but he did share power with his brother. When Pandu died, his eldest son, Yudhishthira, should have succeeded him, but because Yudhishthira was only a boy, Dhritarashtra continued on after Pandu's death. As time passed, however, Dhritarashtra's attachment to his own eldest son, Duryodhana, gradually overcame him. Instead of rising to royal impartiality and allowing Yudhishthira his fair claim, the old blind king began to connive at his son's demand to succeed to the throne. Actually, the line of succession had grown convoluted over several generations, and it was not unthinkable that Duryodhana should rule next. But Yudhishthira's outstanding qualities and Duryodhana's corruption gradually decided the issue, at least from the moral point of view. For Duryodhana, the conflict could be resolved only on the battlefield. Other warriors are mentioned briefly in Chapter 1. Two particularly important figures in the Mahabharata story are Drona and Bhishma. Drona was born a Brahmin, a member of the priestly caste, but in search of wealth, he took up the way of the warrior and excelled in the knowledge of arms. He was the teacher, the guru, of all the royal princes in their youth, the sons of Pandu and the sons of Dhritarashtra alike. Thus it was he who taught both sides the skills of war, an irony which sharp-tongued Duryodhana points out in verse 3. Arjuna was Drona's best pupil when it came to the bow, excelling even Drona's own son, Ashvatthama. Bhishma, the grandsire of both sides, is not actually the prince's grandfather, but a respected elder statesman. As Dhritarashtra's advisor of many years' standing, he considers it his duty to stand by his king and try to protect him from his weaknesses and wrong decisions. Another figure introduced in chapter 1 is Sanjaya, who narrates the entire Gita to the blind king Dhritarashtra. Sanjaya is not present on the battlefield, but the text tells us that the sage, Vyasa, the composer of the Gita, has given him divine sight, so that he can see and report everything. Chapter 1 leaves us acutely aware that we are on a battlefield, waiting for a catastrophic war to begin. But once Krishna begins his instruction, we leave the battlefield behind and enter the realms of philosophy and mystical vision. The first chapter is but a bridge to the real subjects of the Gita, and thus need not detain us too long in our study of the poem. Yet the first chapter has caused a great deal of debate, largely because of what it has to say about the morality of war. Basically, there have been two points of view, which are almost, but perhaps not completely, irreconcilable. First, there is the orthodox Hindu viewpoint that the Gita condones war for the warrior class. It is the dharma, the moral duty of soldiers to fight in a good cause, though never for evil leaders. It should be added that this is part of an elaborate and highly chivalrous code prescribing the just rules of war. According to this orthodox view, the lesson of the Mahabharata, and therefore of the Gita, is that although war is evil, it is an evil that cannot be avoided, an evil both tragic and honourable for the warrior himself. War in a just cause, justly waged, is also in accord with the divine will. Because of this, in the Mahabharata, Yudhishthira and his noble brothers find their peace in the next world, when they finish their duty on earth. The mystics' point of view is more subtle. For them, the battle is an allegory, a cosmic struggle between good and evil. Krishna has revealed himself on earth to re-establish righteousness, and he is asking Arjuna to engage in a spiritual struggle, not a worldly one. According to this interpretation, Arjuna is asked to fight not his kith and kin, but his own lower self. Mahatma Gandhi, who based his daily life on the Gita from his 20s on, felt it would be impossible to live the kind of life taught in the Gita and still engage in violence. To argue that the Gita condones violence, he said, was to give importance only to its opening verses, its preface, so to speak, and ignore the scripture itself. For some, it helps clarify this question to look upon the Gita as an Upanishad, a mystical statement from the Vedas that was incorporated into the warrior epic of a later age. Chapter 1 of the Gita, then, forms a rather perilous bridge between the warrior's world and the essential part of the Gita, Sri Krishna's revelations of spiritual truth. Chapter 1. The War Within. Dhritarashtra.
O Sanjaya, tell me what happened at Kurukshetra, the field of Dharma, where my family and the Pandavas gathered to fight.
Sanjaya.
Having surveyed the forces of the Pandavas arrayed for battle, Prince Duryodhana approached his teacher, Drona, and spoke. O my teacher, look at this mighty army of the Pandavas, assembled by your own gifted disciple Yudhishthira. There are heroic warriors and great archers who are the equals of Bhima and Arjuna, Yayudhana, Virata, the mighty Drupada, Drishtaketu, Chekitana, the valiant king of Kashi, Purujit, Kuntiboja, the great leader Shaibya, the powerful Yudhamanyu, the valiant Uttamojas, and the son of Subhadra, in addition to the sons of Draupadi. All these command mighty chariots. O best of Brahmins, listen to the names of those who are distinguished among our own forces. Bhishma, Karna, and the victorious Kripa. Ashvatthama, Vikarna, and the son of Sumadatta. There are many others too, heroes giving up their lives for my sake, all proficient in war and armed with a variety of weapons. Our army is unlimited and commanded by Bhishma. Theirs is small and commanded by Bhima. Let everyone take his proper place and stand firm supporting Bhishma. Then the powerful Bhishma, the grandsire, oldest of all the Kurus, in order to cheer Duryodhana, roared like a lion and blew his conch horn, and after Bhishma, a tremendous noise arose of conches and cow horns and pounding on drums. Then Sri Krishna and Arjuna, who were standing in a mighty chariot yoked with white horses, blew their divine conches. Sri Krishna blew the conch named Panchajanya, and Arjuna blew that called Devadatta. The mighty Bhima blew the huge conch Poundra. Yudhishthira, the king, the son of Kunti, blew the conch Ananta Vijaya. Nakula and Sahadeva blew their conches as well. Then the king of Kashi, the leading bowman, the great warrior Shikhandi, Trishtadyamnya, Virata, the invincible Satyaki, Drupada, all the sons of Draupadi, and the strong-armed sons of Supadra joined in. And the noise tore through the heart of Duryodhana's army. Indeed, the sound was tumultuous, echoing throughout heaven and earth. Then, O Dhritarashtra, Lord of the Earth, having seen your son's forces set in their places, and the fighting about to begin, Arjuna spoke these words to Sri Krishna.
Arjuna, O Krishna, drive my chariot between the two armies. I want to see those who desire to fight with me. With whom will this battle be fought? I want to see those assemble to fight for Duryodhana, those who seek to please the evil-minded son of Dhritarashtra by engaging in war.
Sanjaya,
thus Arjuna spoke, and Sri Krishna, driving his splendid chariot between the two armies, facing Bhishma and Drona and all the kings of the earth, said,
Arjuna, behold, all the Kurus gathered together.
And Arjuna, standing between the two armies, saw fathers and grandfathers, teachers, uncles and brothers, sons and grandsons, in-laws and friends. Seeing his kinsmen established in opposition, Arjuna was overcome by sorrow. Despairing, he spoke these words.
Arjuna, O Krishna, I see my own relations here anxious to fight, and my limbs grow weak. My mouth is dry, my body shakes, and my hair is standing on end. My skin burns, and the bow Gandiva has slipped from my hand. I am unable to stand. My mind seems to be whirling. These signs bode evil for us. I do not see any good can come from killing our relations in battle. O Krishna, I have no desire for victory, or for a kingdom, or pleasures. Of what use is a kingdom, or pleasure, or even life, if those for whose sake we desire these things, teachers, fathers, sons, grandfathers, uncles, in-laws, grandsons, and others with family ties, are engaging in this battle, renouncing their wealth and their lives? Even if they were to kill me, I would not want to kill them, not even to become ruler of the three worlds, how much less for the earth alone? O Krishna, what satisfaction could we find in killing Dhritarashtra's sons? We would become sinners by slaying these men, even though they are evil. The sons of Dhritarashtra are related to us, therefore we should not kill them. How can we gain happiness by killing members of our own family? Though they are overpowered by greed, and see no evil in destroying families or injuring friends, we see these evils.
Why shouldn't we turn away from this sin? When a family declines, ancient traditions are destroyed. With them are lost the spiritual foundations for life, and the family loses its sense of unity. Where there is no sense of unity, the women of the family become corrupt, and with the corruption of its women, society is plunged into chaos. Social chaos is hell for the family and for those who have destroyed the family as well. It disrupts the process of spiritual evolution begun by our ancestors. The timeless spiritual foundations of family and society would be destroyed by these terrible deeds which violate the unity of life. It is said that those whose family dharma has been destroyed dwell in hell. This is a great sin. We are prepared to kill our own relations out of greed for the pleasures of a kingdom. Better for me if the sons of Dhritarashtra, weapons in hand, were to attack me in battle and kill me unarmed and unresisting. Sanjaya,
overwhelmed by sorrow, Arjuna spoke these words, and casting away his bow and his arrows, he sat down in his chariot in the middle of the battlefield.
Chapter 2. Self-Realization. Introduction. As Arjuna's spiritual teacher, Sri Krishna's task now is to rouse Arjuna from his despair and set him on the way to self-realization. Arjuna is essentially a man of action, renowned for his bravery, nobility, and skill in the arts of war, intelligent but not given to reflection. Yet in his present crisis, he finds that the active life is not enough. He's forced to ask the perennial questions about life and death. Does he have a soul? Does it survive death? Is there a deeper reality than we perceive in the world around us? If so, is it possible to know it directly? And, for Arjuna is always practical, what effect does such knowledge have in everyday life? In his answer, Krishna touches on almost all the main themes and concepts of the Gita. Chapter 2 is thus a kind of overview of the 16 chapters to come. Sri Krishna begins by reminding Arjuna of his immortal nature. His real self, the Atman, never dies, for it is never born. It is eternal. Thus, the Gita does not lead us from stage to stage of spiritual awareness, but begins with the ultimate premise. The immortal soul is more important than the passing world. Knowing he is out of his depth in these inner realms of the mind and spirit, Arjuna formally asks Krishna to be his spiritual teacher, or guru. This is a basic prerequisite of a disciple's initiation in the Hindu tradition, where it is believed that virtually all seekers need the guidance of an experienced teacher. Arjuna is no exception, and he is fortunate to have Krishna himself as his guru. In the allegorical sense, Krishna is a symbol of the Atman, Arjuna's deepest self. This chapter introduces the idea of rebirth, or samsara. The self wears the body as a garment. When the garment is old, it is cast aside, and a new one is put on. Thus the soul, or jiva, travels from life to life. Just as death is certain for the living, rebirth is certain for the dead. Krishna assures Arjuna that his basic nature is not subject to time and death. Yet he reminds him that he cannot realize this truth if he cannot see beyond the dualities of life, pleasure and pain, success and failure, even heat and cold. The Gita does not teach a spirituality aimed at an enjoyable life in the hereafter, nor does it teach a way to enhance power in this life or the next. It teaches a basic detachment from pleasure and pain, as this chapter says more than once. Only in this way can an individual rise above the conditioning of life's dualities and identify with the Atman, the immortal self. Also, the Gita does not teach an enlightenment based on a knowledge of the scriptures. The important thing is direct mystical experience, which Krishna will later urge Arjuna to acquire for himself. This chapter establishes the various definitions of yoga taught in the Gita. Here, the word does not refer to the physical postures and exercises, hatha yoga, it connotes in the West. It refers primarily to disciplining the mind. Yoga is evenness of mind, detachment from the dualities of pain and pleasure, success and failure. Therefore, yoga is skill in action, because this kind of detachment is required if one is to act in freedom, rather than merely react to events compelled by conditioning. Krishna is not trying to persuade Arjuna to lead a different kind of life and renounce the world as would a monk or recluse. He tells Arjuna that if he can establish himself in yoga, in unshakable equanimity, profound peace of mind, he will be more effective in the realm of action. His judgment will be better and his vision clear if he is not emotionally entangled in the outcome of what he does. Arjuna now asks his first question as Krishna's student. His teacher has been talking about spiritual wisdom, direct experiential knowledge of the immortal self. Arjuna wants to know what difference this kind of wisdom makes in everyday life. If a person establishes an ever-present awareness of the core of divinity within himself, how does it affect the way he lives? Arjuna is not interested in what people believe, but in how they conduct themselves in life. Krishna's answer, chapter 2, verses 55 to 72, is one of the most quoted passages in the Gita. Mahatma Gandhi said these verses contain the essence of the Gita. If the rest of the scripture were lost, this passage alone would be enough to teach a complete way of life. Those who are established in wisdom, citta prajna, live in continuous, unbroken awareness that they are not the perishable body, but the Atman. Further, they see the same self in everyone, for the Atman is universally present in all. Such a one, Krishna says, does not identify with personal desires. These desires are on the surface of personality, and the self is its very core. The self-realized man or woman is not motivated by personal desires, in other words, by any desire for karma, personal satisfaction. This idea is perhaps foreign to modern ways of thinking, but basic to the Gita, and indeed to mystics of all traditions. More specifically, the word karma refers to any gratification of the ego or the senses that entangles us in the world of samsara, and thus draws us away from the core of our being, the self. Those established in self-realization control their senses, instead of letting their senses control them. If the senses are not controlled, Krishna warns, the mind, or emotions, will follow wherever they lead. Eventually, a person following the senses loses strength of will and unity of purpose. His choices are dictated by his desires. When the will is led astray by the desire for pleasure, the mind becomes confused and scattered. Ultimately, Krishna warns, this leads to spiritual destruction. When you keep thinking about sense objects, attachment comes. Attachment breeds desire, the lust of possession that burns to anger. Anger clouds the judgment. You can no longer learn from past mistakes. Lost is the power to choose between what is wise and what is unwise. And your life is utter waste. Chapter 2, verse 62 to 63. Yet the Gita does not recommend asceticism. It is more a matter of training the body, mind, and senses. At the very close of the chapter, Krishna introduces the idea that it is not enough to master all selfish desires. It is also necessary to subdue possessiveness and egocentricity. If this ultimate born can be passed, then the seeker will know the true immortal self within. This is the mystic's supreme goal. Knowing their real nature, they know their own immortality and realize their union with eternal being. Chapter 2. Self-realization. Sanjaya.
These are the words that Sri Krishna spoke to the despairing Arjuna, whose eyes were burning with tears of pity and confusion.
Krishna. This despair and weakness in a time of crisis are mean and unworthy of you, Arjuna. How have you fallen into a state so far from the path to liberation? It does not become you to yield to this weakness. Arise with a brave heart and destroy the enemy.
Arjuna, how can I ever bring myself to fight against Bhishma and Drona, who are worthy of reverence? How can I, Krishna? Surely it would be better to spend my life begging than to kill these great and worthy souls. If I killed them, every pleasure I found would be tainted. I don't even know which would be better, for us to conquer them or for them to conquer us. The sons of Dhritarashtra have confronted us. But why would we care to live if we killed them? My will is paralyzed, and I am utterly confused. Tell me which is the better path for me. Let me be your disciple. I have fallen at your feet. Give me instruction. What can overcome a sorrow that saps all my vitality? Even power over men and gods or the wealth of an empire seem empty.
Sanjaya.
This is how Arjuna, the great warrior, spoke to Sri Krishna. With the words, O Krishna, I will not fight. He fell silent. As they stood between the two armies, Sri Krishna smiled and replied to Arjuna, who had sunk into despair.
Krishna, you speak sincerely, but your sorrow has no cause. The wise grieve neither for the living nor the dead. There has never been a time when you and I and the kings gathered here have not existed, nor will there be a time when we will cease to exist. As the same person inhabits the body through childhood, youth, and old age, so too at the time of death he attains another body. The wise are not deluded by these changes. When the senses contact sense objects, a person experiences cold or heat, pleasure or pain. These experiences are fleeting. They come and go. Bear them patiently, Arjuna. Those who are unaffected by these changes, who are the same in pleasure and pain, are truly wise and fit for immortality. Assert your strength and realize this. The impermanent has no reality. Reality lies in the eternal. Those who have seen the boundary between these two have attained the end of all knowledge. Realize that which pervades the universe and is indestructible. No power can affect this unchanging, imperishable reality. The body is mortal, but that which dwells in the body is immortal and immeasurable. Therefore, Arjuna, fight in this battle. One believes he is the slayer. Another believes he is the slain. Both are ignorant. There is neither slayer nor slain. You were never born. You will never die. You have never changed. You can never change. Unborn, eternal, immutable, immemorial. You do not die when the body dies. Realizing that which is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and unchanging, how can you slay or cause another to slay? As one abandons worn-out clothes and acquires new ones, so when the body is worn out, a new one is acquired by the self who lives within. The self cannot be pierced by weapons or burned by fire. Water cannot wet it, nor can the wind dry it. The self cannot be pierced or burned, made wet or dry. It is everlasting and infinite, standing on the motionless foundations of eternity. The self is unmanifested, beyond all thought, beyond all change. Knowing this, you should not grieve. O mighty Arjuna, even if you believe the self to be subject to birth and death, you should not grieve. Death is inevitable for the living. Birth is inevitable for the dead. Since these are unavoidable, you should not sorrow. Every creature is unmanifested at first, and then attains manifestation. When its end has come, it once again becomes unmanifested. What is there to lament in this? The glory of the self is beheld by a few, and a few describe it. A few listen, but many without understanding. The self of all beings, living within the body, is eternal and cannot be harmed. Therefore, do not grieve. Considering your dharma, you should not vacillate. For a warrior, nothing is higher than a war against evil. The warrior confronted with such a war should be pleased, Arjuna, for it comes as an open gate to heaven. But if you do not participate in this battle against evil, you will incur sin, violating your dharma and your honor. The story of your dishonor will be repeated endlessly, and for a man of honor, dishonor is worse than death. These brave warriors will think you have withdrawn from battle out of fear, and those who formerly esteemed you will treat you with disrespect. Your enemies will ridicule your strength and say things that should not be said. What could be more painful than this? Death means the attainment of heaven. Victory means the enjoyment of the earth. Therefore, rise up, Arjuna, resolved to fight. Having made yourself alike in pain and pleasure, profit and loss, victory and defeat, engage in this great battle and you will be freed from sin. You have heard the intellectual explanation of Sankhya, Arjuna. Now listen to the principles of yoga. By practicing these, you can break through the bonds of karma. On this path, effort never goes to waste, and there is no failure. Even a little effort towards spiritual awareness will protect you from the greatest fear. Those who follow this path, resolving deep within themselves to seek me alone, attain singleness of purpose. For those who lack resolution, the decisions of life are many-branched and endless. There are ignorant people who speak flowery words and take delight in the letter of the law, saying that there is nothing else. Their hearts are full of selfish desires, Arjuna. Their idea of heaven is their own enjoyment, and the aim of all their activities is pleasure and power. The fruit of their actions is continual rebirth. Those whose minds are swept away by the pursuit of pleasure and power are incapable of following the supreme goal and will not attain samadhi. The scriptures describe the three gunas, but you should be free from the action of the gunas, established in eternal truth, self-controlled, without any sense of duality or the desire to acquire and hoard. Just as a reservoir is of little use when the whole countryside is flooded, scriptures are of little use to the illumined man or woman who sees the Lord everywhere. You have the right to work, but never to the fruit of work. You should never engage in action for the sake of reward, nor should you long for inaction.
Perform work in this world, Arjuna, as a man established within himself,
without selfish attachments, and alike in success and defeat.
For yoga is perfect evenness of mind.
Seek refuge in the attitude of detachment, and you will amass the wealth of spiritual awareness. Those who are motivated only by desire for the fruits of action are miserable, for they are constantly anxious about the results of what they do. When consciousness is unified, however, all vain anxiety is left behind. There is no cause for worry, whether things go well or ill. Therefore, devote yourself to the disciplines of yoga, for yoga is skill in action. The wise unify their consciousness and abandon attachment to the fruits of action, which binds a person to continual rebirth. Thus, they attain a state beyond all evil. When your mind has overcome the confusion of duality, you will attain the state of holy indifference to things you hear and things you have heard. When you are unmoved by the confusion of ideas, and your mind is completely united in deep samadhi, you will attain the state of perfect yoga.
Arjuna, tell me of those who live established in wisdom, ever aware of the self, O Krishna. How do they talk? How sit? How move about?
Krishna, they live in wisdom who see themselves in all, and all in them, who have renounced every selfish desire and sense-craving tormenting the heart. Neither agitated by grief, nor hankering after pleasure, they live free from lust and fear and anger. Established in meditation, they are truly wise. Fettered no more by selfish attachments, they are neither elated by good fortune nor depressed by bad. Such are the seers. Even as a tortoise draws in its limbs, the wise can draw in their senses at will. Aspirants abstain from sense pleasures, but they still crave for them. These cravings all disappear when they see the highest goal. Even of those who tread the path, the stormy senses can sweep off the mind. They live in wisdom who subdue their senses and keep their minds ever absorbed in me. When you keep thinking about sense objects, attachment comes. Attachment breeds desire, the lust of possession, which burns to anger. Anger clouds the judgment. You can no longer learn from past mistakes. Lost is the power to choose between what is wise and what is unwise, and your life is utter waste. But when you move amidst the world of sense, free from attachment and aversion alike, there comes the peace in which all sorrows end, and you live in the wisdom of the self. The disunited mind is far from wise. How can it meditate? How be at peace? When you know no peace, how can you know joy? When you let your mind follow the call of the senses, they carry away your better judgment, as storms drive a boat off its charted course on the sea. Use all your power to free the senses from attachment and aversion alike, and live in the full wisdom of the self. Such a sage awakes to light in the night of all creatures. That which the world calls day is the night of ignorance to the wise. As rivers flow into the ocean, but cannot make the vast ocean overflow, so flow the streams of the sense world into the sea of peace that is the sage. But this is not so with the desirer of desires. They are forever free who renounce all selfish desires and break away from the ego cage of I, me, and mine, to be united with the Lord. This is the supreme state. Attain to this and pass from death to immortality. Chapter 3. Selfless Service. Introduction. The title of this chapter in Sanskrit is Karma Yoga, the Way of Action. And here we take an apparently sharp turn away from the subject of the previous chapter. In fact, Arjuna changes the subject completely. Krishna has been trying to convince him that he has an immortal soul. But Arjuna continues to worry about his immediate predicament. It is not that he is uninterested in mystical enlightenment, but his main concern at the moment is just what he is supposed to do next. Or he asks, perhaps what he does is not so important after all. Has Krishna been telling him to concentrate on acquiring spiritual wisdom and to forget about his apparent duties in the world? Krishna replies that there is no way Arjuna can avoid the obligation of selfless action, or karma yoga. Arjuna must act selflessly, out of a sense of duty. He must work, not for his own sake, but for the welfare of all. Krishna points out that this is a basic law underlying all creation. Each being must do its part in the grand scheme of things, and there is no way to avoid this obligation, except perhaps by the complete enlightenment which loosens all the old bonds of karma. Here the Gita refers to the doctrine of karma, one of the basic teachings in all Hindu and Buddhist scriptures. Karma literally means deed or action. What is sometimes called the law of karma refers to an underlying law of cause and effect that is seen to permeate all existence. The idea is that every action leads to a reasonable result, and consequently, that everything that happens can be traced to something done in the past. Actions determine destiny. This is the basic idea of karma. If anything happens to us that is truly good, we must have done something in the past to deserve it. If something ill befalls us, then at some time in the past we did something that was not so meritorious. This is a basic moral law that all great spiritual traditions share, the belief that we reap what we sow. The Hindu tradition gives a great deal of thought to this problem of moral cause and effect, and generation after generation of spiritual teachers fathomed its depths and implications. One fear that developed over time was that all action was in a sense an open door to bondage. Anything a person did would bind him to the endless cycle of cause and effect. Some fruits of action would of course be pleasant, not all karma is painful. But even this pleasure could be a trap, because we would seek it compulsively, tying ourselves tighter and tighter to the responsibilities and opportunities of the worldly life, and forgetting our spiritual dimension altogether. In Chapter 3, Krishna begins to tell Arjuna the way out of this maze of cause and effect. It is not to avoid work, especially his duties required by his station in life, but to perform those duties without selfish attachment to their fruit or outcome. If Arjuna follows this path of selfless work, Krishna explains, he will enjoy this world as well as the next. More important, he will gain a spiritual blessing and will be lessening his debt of karma. Only when he is free from every bond of karma, every consequence of past action, can he achieve life's ultimate goal. The world is bound in its own activity, for all creatures, except the illumined man or woman, work for their own pleasure and gain. Because they act selfishly, they are bound by the results, whether good or bad. We must act in a selfless spirit, Krishna says, without ego involvement and without getting entangled in whether things work out the way we want. Only then will we not fall into the terrible net of karma. We cannot hope to escape karma by refraining from our duties. Even to survive in the world, we must act. True, the Hindu scriptures do hold out another path, jnana yoga, the path of wisdom, which does not enjoin action. But Krishna does not really offer this to Arjuna as an alternative. It is acknowledged and then dropped. Perhaps Krishna knows that Arjuna is not the type to disengage himself and go off on a search for the mystical vision. For Arjuna, the active life is essential. The danger, of course, of a life of active engagement in the world is that Arjuna will get caught up in his actions and begin to act out of selfish motives. If this were to happen, he would be doomed to spiritual failure. Having a good deal of self-knowledge, Arjuna senses this danger. He asks Krishna a fundamental question. What power binds us to our selfish ways? Even if we wish to act rightly, so often we do the wrong thing. What power moves us? Krishna replies that anger and selfish desire are our greatest enemies. They are the destructive powers that can compel us to wander away from our purpose, to end up in self-delusion and despair. Here it is necessary to introduce two technical terms from Hindu philosophy. The Gita is not an academic work of philosophy, but a poetic, practical text. Still, it does refer from time to time to Sankhya, one of the six traditional schools of Indian philosophy. In Sankhya, the phenomenal world of mind and matter is described as having three basic qualities, or gunas: sattva, goodness, light, purity; rajas, passion, activity, energy; and tamas, darkness, ignorance, inertia. According to Sankhya, spiritual evolution progresses from tamas to rajas to sattva, and final liberation takes the soul beyond the three gunas altogether. Here Krishna warns Arjuna to beware the pitfalls of rajas, for it is from rajas that anger and selfish desire arise. Arjuna must realize that his true nature, the Atman, is above entanglement in the gunas. The gunas act and react upon one another, but Arjuna's inner being is not affected. If he cannot reach this detachment, he will be always caught in the emotional storms of passion, rajas, or the quagmires of inertia, tamas, which alternate in dominating the mind and body. Krishna offers Arjuna the example of King Janaka, well known from holy legend as a model for the princely estate. Janaka was a king who ruled well and did not shirk his responsibilities, yet he was detached and worked from a sense of duty, not for personal gain or enjoyment. He was revered as a royal sage who pursued his enlightenment not by renouncing the world, but by working in it and contributing to its welfare, thus enjoying the best of both worlds. Chapter 3. Selfless Service. Arjuna. O Krishna, you have said that knowledge is greater than action. Why then do you ask me to wage this terrible war? Your advice seems inconsistent. Give me one path to follow to the supreme good. Krishna. At the beginning of time, I declared two paths for the pure of heart: jnana yoga, the contemplative path of spiritual wisdom, and karma yoga, the active path of selfless service. One who shirks action does not attain freedom. No one can gain perfection by abstaining from work. Indeed, there is no one who rests for even an instant. All creatures are driven to action by their own nature. Those who abstain from action, while allowing the mind to dwell on sensual pleasure, cannot be called sincere spiritual aspirants. but they excel who control their senses through the mind, using them for selfless service.
Fulfill all your duties. Action is better than inaction.
Even to maintain your body, Arjuna, you are obliged to act. Selfish action imprisons the world. Act selflessly, without any thought of personal profit. At the beginning, mankind and the obligation of selfless service were created together. Through selfless service, you will always be fruitful and find the fulfillment of your desires. This is the promise of the Creator.
Honor and cherish the Devas as they honor and cherish you. Through this honor and love, you will attain the supreme good.
All human desires are fulfilled by the Devas, who are pleased by selfless service. But anyone who enjoys the things given by the Devas without offering selfless acts in return is a thief. The spiritually minded who eat in the spirit of service are freed from all their sins, but the selfish who prepare food for their own satisfaction eat sin. Living creatures are nourished by food, and food is nourished by rain. Rain itself is the water of life, which comes from selfless worship and service.
Every selfless act, Arjuna, is born from Brahman, the eternal infinite Godhead.
Brahman is present in every act of service. All life turns on this law, O Arjuna. Those who violate it, indulging the senses for their own pleasure and ignoring the needs of others, have wasted their life. But those who realize the self are always satisfied. Having found the source of joy and fulfillment, they no longer seek happiness from the external world. They have nothing to gain or lose by any action. Neither people nor things can affect their security.
Strive constantly to serve the welfare of the world. By devotion to selfless work, one attains the supreme goal of life.
Do your work with the welfare of others always in mind. It was by such work that Janaka attained perfection. Others too have followed this path.
What the outstanding person does, others will try to do. The standards such people create will be followed by the whole world.
There is nothing in the three worlds for me to gain, Arjuna. Nor is there anything I do not have. I continue to act, but I am not driven by any need of my own.
If I ever refrained from continuous work, everyone would immediately follow my example. If I stopped working, I would be the cause of cosmic chaos, and finally of the destruction of this world and these people.
The ignorant work for their own profit, Arjuna. The wise work for the welfare of the world, without thought for themselves.
By abstaining from work, you will confuse the ignorant who are engrossed in their own actions.
Perform all work carefully, guided by compassion.
All actions are performed by the gunas of Prakriti.
Deluded by identification with the ego, a person thinks, I am the doer.
But the illumined man or woman understands the domain of the gunas and is not attached.
Such people know that the gunas interact with each other. They do not claim to be the doer.
Those who are deluded by the operation of the gunas become attached to the results of their action.
Those who understand these truths should not unsettle the ignorant.
Performing all actions for my sake, completely absorbed in the self, and without expectations, fight.
But stay free from the fever of the ego.
Those who live in accordance with these divine laws, without complaining
firmly established in faith, are released from karma. Those who violate these laws, criticizing and complaining, are utterly deluded and are the cause of their own suffering. Even the wise act within the limitations of their own nature. Every creature is subject to prakriti. What is the use of repression? The senses have been conditioned by attraction to the pleasant and aversion to the unpleasant. Do not be ruled by them. They are obstacles in your path. It is better to strive in one's own dharma than to succeed in the dharma of another. Nothing is ever lost in following one's own dharma, but competition in another's dharma breeds fear and insecurity. Arjuna, what is the force that binds us to selfish deeds, O Krishna? What power moves us, even against our will, as if forcing us? Krishna, it is selfish desire and anger, arising from the guna of rajas. These are the appetites and evils which threaten a person in this life. Just as a fire is covered by smoke, and a mirror is obscured by dust, just as the embryo rests deep within the womb, knowledge is hidden by selfish desire. Hidden, Arjuna, by this unquenchable fire for self-satisfaction, the inveterate enemy of the wise. Selfish desire is found in the senses, mind, and intellect, misleading them and burying the understanding in delusion. Fight with all your strength, Arjuna. Controlling your senses, conquer your enemy, the destroyer of knowledge and realization. The senses are higher than the body, the mind higher than the senses. Above the mind is the intellect, and above the intellect is the Atman. Thus, knowing that which is supreme, let the Atman rule the ego. Use your mighty arms to slay the fierce enemy that is selfish desire. Chapter 4. Wisdom in Action. Introduction. Krishna is eager to grant Arjuna knowledge of the highest spiritual truths, or even a rare mystical vision. But Arjuna has been asking for Krishna to simply get him out of his present difficulties. Of course, these difficulties are not minor. He is caught in a family tragedy that has developed into a vicious conflict. If he cannot extricate himself, he knows that he will have to take part in a catastrophic battle that no one wants. So when Krishna begins to tell Arjuna about the secret teachings he will be privileged to hear because he is Krishna's favorite devotee and friend, it hardly registers in Arjuna's consciousness. His reply is confused. How could you have taught any secret wisdom to the sages of old? He asks. At this point, Krishna reminds Arjuna again of the process of rebirth. They have both been reborn many times, but naturally Arjuna does not remember his past lives because he has no access to this kind of knowledge. Krishna remembers his former births, but he is no ordinary being. He reveals that he has chosen to take on human birth many times for the welfare of the world. Whenever dharma, the law of life's unity, declines, he wraps himself in his maya and takes on a finite form. Thus he returns age after age. Vishnu, the preserving or sustaining person of the Hindu Trinity, is not mentioned here. But Krishna is usually looked upon as an incarnation of this aspect of God. As the Lord Krishna explains, he dwells in every being, but he is manifested with special power in his incarnations, or avatars. Avatara literally means descent. Vishnu is believed to descend and incarnate himself on earth from age to age to re-establish divine law, Dharma. Without such intervention, the entire created universe would go into decline. The natural course of creation is to go through cycles of regeneration and decay. But Vishnu, Krishna, has compassion for all the suffering of the world and comes himself to protect the good and destroy evil. Thus Vishnu has a special relationship with all beings. He personifies the aspect of God who so loves the world that he comes into it to re-establish the purity and happiness of the Golden Age. Krishna here reveals a little of his hidden divine nature. He tells Arjuna that mystical union with him is possible through devotion, by which one can enter the state of divine love in which one sees God in every creature. Krishna also takes on the role of creator. It is he who has patterned the world along the lines of guna and karma. This mystic aspect of Krishna's being dominates the Gita. In the Mahabharata, Krishna is a princely ally who is wise and daring in his support of his friend Arjuna. But the author of the Gita is not concerned with this Krishna. He turns his attention to the mystery of Krishna's divine nature as an aspect of Vishnu. In this sense, Krishna is the inner self in all beings. His name comes from the Sanskrit root Krish, to draw to oneself, to attract. He is the attractive one, the Lord of loving attraction. By another etymology, the word Krishna means the dark one. The author of the Gita sees revealed in him the ultimate Godhead, the supreme being. But this reality is often veiled, and then Krishna is seen as an ordinary human being, or rather as an exceptionally gifted man, but not as God. Many of Krishna's words make most sense when we realize that when he speaks of himself, he is often not describing a transcendental reality, so much as trying to tell Arjuna about the self in every human being. When he says, for example, "Actions do not cling to me because I am not attached to their results," he means, "Arjuna, actions do not cling to your real self." The self in us is not touched by action. Whatever we do, it remains unsullied. Those who understand this about themselves and practice it live in freedom. The latter part of this chapter turns from lofty mystical topics back to Arjuna's immediate problem. Krishna begins to talk about action and work and things that should be done and should not be done. It is essential, he reminds Arjuna, to act wisely, with detachment. The wise never act with selfish attachment to the fruit of their labor. They give their best in fortune and misfortune alike. Such people act in freedom. The next section deals with the various kinds of yajna, worship or offering, that may be performed by spiritual aspirants of differing temperaments. Hindu rituals often involve making an offering to the gods by pouring an oblation into the sacred fire. Here the image is the same. Whatever is offered is symbolically thrown into a consuming fire that carries the offering to God. The offering may be as obvious as worldly goods, or as subtle as knowledge or meditation. In any case, it requires a measure of self-sacrifice. Yajna is a basic action necessary to life, and those who do not perform some kind of selfless service find no home in this world or the next. The final verses of chapter 4 introduce a new principle. In the last chapter, Krishna mentioned the path of spiritual wisdom as an alternative to the path of action, or karma yoga. Now he reveals that wisdom is the goal of selfless action. Knowing is the fruit of doing. The goal of all karma yoga, or yajna, is liberation and spiritual wisdom. The fire of spiritual awareness burns to ashes even a great heap of karma. Thus, true knowledge is the greatest purifier of the soul. Krishna ends by by exhorting Arjuna to cut through the doubts that still stifle him. This is the first, but not the last, mention that Krishna makes of Arjuna's doubting heart. There has been no indication so far that Arjuna has taken in and accepted Krishna's words. But even though Arjuna continues to drag his feet, Krishna does not abandon him. Chapter 4. Wisdom in Action. Krishna, I told this eternal secret to Vivaswat. Vivaswat taught Manu, and Manu taught Ishvaku. Thus, Arjuna, eminent sages receive knowledge of yoga in a continuous tradition. But through time, the practice of yoga was lost in the world. The secret of these teachings is profound. I have explained them to you today because you are my friend and devotee. Arjuna, you were born much after Vivaswat. He lived very long ago. Why do you say that you taught this yoga in the beginning? Krishna, you and I have passed through many births, Arjuna. You have forgotten, but I remember them all. My true being is unborn and changeless. I am the Lord who dwells in every creature. Through the power of my own Maya, I manifest myself in a finite form. Whenever Dharma declines and the purpose of life is forgotten, I manifest myself on earth. I am born in every age to protect the good, to destroy evil, and to re-establish Dharma. Those who know me as their own divine self break through the belief that they are the body and are not reborn as separate creatures. Such a one, Arjuna, is united with me. Delivered from selfish attachment, fear, and anger, filled with me, surrendering themselves to me, purified in the fire of my being, many have reached the state of unity in me. As they approach me, so I receive them. All paths, Arjuna, lead to me. Those desiring success in their actions worship the gods. Through action in the world of mortals, their desires are quickly fulfilled. The distinctions of caste, guna, and karma have come from me. I am their cause, but I myself am changeless and beyond all action. Actions do not cling to me because I am not attached to their results. Those who understand this and practice it live in freedom. Knowing this truth, aspirants desiring liberation in ancient times engaged in action. You too can do the same, pursuing an active life in the manner of those ancient sages. What is action, and what is inaction? This question has confused the greatest sages. I will give you the secret of action, with which you can free yourself from bondage. The true nature of action is difficult to grasp. You must understand what is action and what is inaction, and what kind of action should be avoided. The wise see that there is action in the midst of inaction, and inaction in the midst of action. Their consciousness is unified, and every act is done with complete awareness. The awakened sages call a person wise when all his undertakings are free from anxiety about results. All his selfish desires have been consumed in the fire of knowledge. The wise, ever satisfied, have abandoned all external supports. Their security is unaffected by the results of their action, even while acting, they really do nothing at all. Free from expectations and from all sense of possession, with mind and body firmly controlled by the self, they do not incur sin by the performance of physical action. They live in freedom who have gone beyond the dualities of life. Competing with no one, they are alike in success and failure, and content with whatever comes to them. They are free, without selfish attachments. Their minds are fixed in knowledge. They perform all work in the spirit of service, and their karma is dissolved. The process of offering is Brahman. That which is offered is Brahman. Brahman offers the sacrifice in the fire of Brahman. Brahman is attained by those who see Brahman in every action. Some aspirants offer material sacrifices to the gods. Others offer selfless service as sacrifice in the fire of Brahman. Some renounce all enjoyment of the senses, sacrificing them in the fire of sense restraint. Others partake of sense objects, but offer them in service through the fire of the senses. Some offer the workings of the senses and the vital forces through the fire of self-control, kindled in the path of knowledge. Some offer wealth. Others offer sense restraint and suffering. Some take vows and offer knowledge and study of the scriptures, and some make the offering of meditation. Some offer the forces of vitality, regulating their inhalation and exhalation, and thus gain control over these forces. Others offer the forces of vitality through restraint of their senses. All these understand the meaning of service and will be cleansed of their impurities. True sustenance is in service, and through it a man or woman reaches the eternal Brahman. But those who do not seek to serve are without a home in this world. Arjuna, how can they be at home in any world to come? These offerings are born of work, and each guides mankind along a path to Brahman. Understanding this, you will attain liberation. The offering of wisdom is better than any material offering, Arjuna, for the goal of all work is spiritual wisdom. Approach those who have realized the purpose of life and question them with reverence and devotion. They will instruct you in this wisdom. Once you attain it, you will never again be deluded. You will see all creatures in the self and all in me. Even if you were the most sinful of sinners, Arjuna, you could cross beyond all sin by the raft of spiritual wisdom. As the heat of a fire reduces wood to ashes, the fire of knowledge burns to ashes all karma. Nothing in this world purifies like spiritual wisdom. It is the perfection achieved in time through the path of yoga, the path which leads to the self within. Those who take wisdom as their highest goal, whose faith is deep and whose senses are trained, attain wisdom quickly and enter into perfect peace. But the ignorant, indecisive, and lacking in faith waste their lives. They can never be happy in this world or any other. Those established in the self have renounced selfish attachments to their actions and cut through doubts with spiritual wisdom. They act in freedom. Arjuna, cut through this doubt in your own heart with the sword of spiritual wisdom. Arise, take up the path of yoga.